Okay, so good morning. Today is November 14th, 2011, and we're doing Sefer Chinuch Mitzvot 191, hopefully through 206. Okay, now start your time.
Vis-a-vis the prohibition of conjugal intimacy with one's father.
Other's wife.
Well, whatever.
All kinds. We have all kinds of stuff here.
The last Torah portion was on Lot's daughters, and so two things were brought out. One is that it said that the father, of course, was drunk and didn't know it. So the first daughter, slept with him and, slept and then got up quickly and left. And the idea behind it was that Lot really didn't know what was going on, and he was kind of in a stupor and didn't really enjoy it. But the second daughter did the same thing, but by then Lot kind of knew what was going on.
And she plied him with alcohol.
Yes.
So she got him.
Yes, he was drunk. Mm-hmm. But the sages say out that by the time the second daughter came around, Lot's lechery also arose, and he actually enjoyed the second daughter. Whereas first daughter, he was a little bit more drunk, and by the time the second daughter came around, he actually enjoyed it. That was one thing. And the second thing was the daughters did this thinking that the entire world was destroyed. But there were five cities, of which Sodom and Gomorrah were only two. There were five that were part of this destruction. And Lot knew that only Sodom and Gomorrah were going to be destroyed. The other three were going to be left intact. So he knew
that
the whole
world
was not destroyed.
Well, he knew that, but they didn't know that.
They didn't know that.
Right.
So he could have very well have said, not to worry, there's other people around, you don't have to sleep with me, I'll find you a nice husband and the other two, or whatever. But he kind of let the whole process take. But essentially, though, good came out of it because Moab was the progenitor of Ruth, and ultimately Solomon's wife came.
David Amalek.
I mean, it had to happen that way.
Right.
But it was just interesting that kind of picked up on this whole thing.
Right. So it's interesting because their intent was L'shem Shemaim. So what you're saying is that Lot could have, it's not
corrected
even about
them.
The sex. He could have corrected them, not that they discussed it with him.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure they didn't say, Dad, we're going to do this because we're the last ones, and he didn't correct them. That's not what happened.
But surely they showed fear. What are we going to do?
Right. And that's where he didn't correct them.
Right.
That's where he didn't.
And then he actually enjoyed it, which shows this sort of whole sexual thing that they're having a prohibition on right now.
Interesting. Interesting. There's an extremely low circulation joke. I probably told it to you last year, but I'll just tell it to you again. So, there's a book. You have to know this for the joke. There's a book called My Uncle the Netziv. Right? The Netziv is Rabbi Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin. Netziv, right? So there's a book written by his nephew, My Uncle the Netziv. But Netziv also means a pillar. Right? So the joke for that last week's parsha is, did you hear that Yitzchak Avinu published a book? No. What is it called? My Aunt the Netziv. Right? Because Lot's wife is Yitzchak's aunt, and she turned into a pillar of salt.
Right.
Told you, it's a very low circulation. You have to know all that stuff to get that joke.
Even
if you know all that stuff, it's funny, but...
Lost in translation.
Yeah.
Anyway,
okay. That's the Parsha joke for last week. Okay. So we're going to go through a lot of these pretty quickly because they're very similar, each one. Obviously, they're all their own thing and really could take in-depth study. It's just interesting to look at it as a whole group. So many prohibitions on so many close relatives. Why not just say close relatives? Why say each one?
Like what's right. That would be the question.
So similar, right? But each one is its own separate mitzvah. So one concept here is that Ratza HaKadosh Baruch Hu L'zakot Et Yisrael L'fichach Yirbeh Lahem Torah Mitzvot. Right, so Hashem wanted to bring merit to the Jews, and therefore he increased for them Torah mitzvot, right? So the more mitzvot we have, the more actual pathways we have to, not choice
of course,
pathways.
Any of these are, so you get credit for not doing any of them one by one?
Right.
I understand, but in a way...
right. Right, in a way not, right.
It can work on the reverse. there's more to break, more to not absorb.
But all of these, right. It seems, yeah.
Well, all of these seem pretty, like, they're not even so much in the realm of desire, most of them.
I was going to say, it's the unusual circumstances, situation, an individual that would even find themselves in the context of having to consciously make a decision not to do it or to follow the mitzvah or whatever.
Right.
I mean,
so
it happens, but.
Mitzvah 190, which I'm not quite sure where we stopped last week, but I think that's where we stopped. Mitzvah 190 is on the ban on carnal relations with one's mother. So that's where it discusses consanguineous relations, and certainly a mother is consanguineous. But in this list that we have for today, there's plenty of close relations that are not blood relations. So it's not all about blood, but I just do want to review, because he refers to it regularly throughout all these mitzvot, the reasons for not having consanguineous relations. So reason number one, according to the Rambam, is that, so the first reason that Rambam gives is, he says that the Torah would remove conjugal intimacy from human beings except for that which is necessary for reproduction or for a religious duty. Therefore, the Torah prohibited near relations to us because one is more likely to succumb to misfortune with them since they are about us constantly. So that's reason number one, which the Ramban in the next paragraph says is a very weak reason, because a person is allowed to, if it's just to reduce those that you can have sex with, well, that doesn't make sense at all, because a person can marry, a man technically can marry 100 wives if he wants to. So he'd have many people that he could have sex with. So it's not really about reducing the amount of people with whom you could have sex. So what is that? So the Ramban says that really it's about having dysfunctional, dim-witted, unwhole children that will happen from those relations. But that can't be the whole thing either, because in this list we have a lot of non-consanguineous relationships or far enough apart that would not result in that feeble-mindedness. So reason number one to reduce sex, really.
Partners.
Reason number two, to reduce sex partners, right. Reason number two, to prevent whatever would be broken in genetic relationships that are too close. And reason number three, it says here, Rambam, a blessed member, wrote another reason as well about the matter, and I think this is the main reason, but he doesn't go into it, by way of plain meaning to my mind. He stated that the Torah imposes a barrier in order that a man should not be so arrogant as to be conjugally intimate with the woman whom properly he ought to treat with respect. And he strains to explain most of them in this vein, i.e. on account of the quality of shame, all as it is set forth in his work. But it would draw the subject out unduly if we undertook to write the whole thing here. So, of course you're supposed to treat your wife with respect, and sex doesn't reduce respect. However, there is something about a crossing of boundaries which you want in a marriage that you don't want in any other relationship.
That it talks about a fence. You know, the Torah.
Well, there's fences all around, but so the question is, but why? Why in these relations? Why with your sister? Not.
Or the daughter of a.
Right, and all those other things. Why with? Right. So we did touch on last time. I know it was a long time ago. I'm sorry. We did touch on the fact that all those female relatives are softening agents in the life of a man. The sister, the mother, the daughter. And the wife, but certainly the women, and we talked about how in the Wild West, you know, when men were missing women to soften them, to soften society, and how so that relationship is important, and that you wouldn't want to introduce sexuality into that, because then that takes away perhaps the softening ability of it. And I think with a wife is different than, you know, those other relations in terms of softening.
It complicates other relationships.
Definitely,
well.
It would complicate,
right.
So I think that's part of it, is respecting the power that's available in those separate relationships. So respecting the power of the feminine without sexuality. So that being said, it's an interesting thing. I was driving with my kids today to Auraria campus, and Donnie said, "Why is it that all lesbians are not pretty?" And the vehicle said, "What do you mean? How could you say that?" I said, "Well, all of them that I've met aren't." She said, "Well, probably because they're not trying to attract you. They're probably trying to attract women, which is a different kind of a look." So we were discussing attraction, and I think there is something about that. It's not that, of course, there could be pretty, you know, everybody comes in different shapes and sizes, and, you know, so that can't be. However, there is something about sending out waves of attraction.
So, DeGeneres' wife is attractive.
Yeah, Patricia DeRossi.
Yeah, I think she's attractive.
Uh-huh. So I was just thinking about what does that mean, and how, as, also as an Eshet Ish, as married women, it is our job not to send out those attraction waves, you know, because we do. We are, and so, and I think about, if you look at, it's amazing to look at maternity clothes today. They're so sexy. It's like, really? You know, it's just amazing to me.
It depends upon whether you think really bikinis and tight things and all that and a pregnant are, I mean...
I'm saying it's designed to be as if it's sexy. I mean, of course, it depends on the man,
right.
You know, if he's attracted to that. But they're low cut and they're short skirts and they're like
very form fitting.
Very form fitting, and they are they're if they weren't maternity ish, they would be sexy. Like, let's say you had that in a size 6 on a non pregnant body, that style would be sexy. So what are you putting that on a pregnant woman for, just with enough room for her belly? You know, why should she be sending out waves of sexuality on the street?
Mm-hmm.
Right, not that you can't be sexual as a pregnant woman with your husband, but you shouldn't be sending out waves of "come and get me."
Right.
You know, that's like
right.
So. And but that is what a lot of our fashion is about: is "come and get me." Turns out that the latest wave that's coming is extra demure. Everybody go to your grandmother's closets. That's what they say in the Times. Is that
oh,
you know?
I saw that article. Yeah. It's back
mm-hmm. Take out the pearls, the high necks. Right. That's right.
Good.
Yep.
Well, that's good.
The scarves tied under the chin,
yeah.
Even.
Yes.
Yeah. The whole look. Yeah. The suits. Yeah.
Good.
Very.
Well, I'm really tired of these.
Very
50s
and 60s.
9-year-old little girls looking like they're about 15. So.
Right. Right. Anyway. So I think there is something about sending out waves of attraction. So one of the things that this does is say, all these people are cut off from you. So really, yes, there's extra room to transgress, but also all these people then can cut off sending out waves of attraction. So that you can do the other stuff in you can do the other stuff in the relationship then. You can just say that there doesn't have to be any sexual energy at all because they're all forbidden. So let's get to the rest of the relationship. Right, so that's like, you know, I mean, that's what complicates so many things. You know, the classic, you know, professor and his, you know, female graduate student. So there is sexual energy there, even if he's married. There's something because she's for sure in that mode of sending out, you know, the young girls.
Right.
And I think that's one reason why, in the frum world, young couples, married couples even, don't necessarily invite each other for Shabbos because. When you're still young, you're still sending out those waves. You haven't learned how to kind of click
and the
that
guy
off.
Is still very vulnerable.
Right, and the guy is still very vulnerable. You have to wait till you're a little older when you've kind
really?
Of settled into marriage
yeah.
more, and you both and the woman knows, like, it just isn't sending out the waves, and the men aren't as vulnerable. But in those early years, it's still.
So that no comparisons.
No comparisons and no attraction. And yeah, you want
to
make sure your marriage is solid before your husband goes looking at some other pretty girl.
All of that.
Yeah. You don't need to put a 20-year-old girl, even in a snood, at your husband's table. He should be looking at her. You know, he should be looking at you. Invite the 35-year-olds over where he's not looking.
Us almost 74-year-olds.
Right.
There you go. Right,
right.
That's a nice, safe thing.
Right. So anyway, I just wanted to mention that idea of sending out those attraction waves, like what we do and the energy that we spend in that. So we're in this room spending much less energy in that than, let's say, for sure in high school. And I think that's something to think about, even in the difference between, let's say, public high school and Beis Yaakov High School. All the energy that we expend in high school, sending out those waves, developing the capacity to send those waves, it probably takes a third to half, maybe even more, of our total energy output.
Well, they say that about same, not just even a religious high school, but
right.
a same-sex
high school. But the more separate you are, I think, the more you can spend
probably.
All that energy on yourself.
And growing.
Yeah, rather than sending it out, you can use that energy to cultivate in. So I think that does create a very different high school product. You know, 18-year-old Beis Yaakov graduate is very different than a Cherry Creek 18-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
They might have the same academic information, but in terms of mm-hmm. self-development and direction in life, it's very
right.
different.
Very different.
Yeah, it was so funny when I was just in Detroit, so I spoke to the Maimonides group. Maimonides is a quote-unquote scholars program on college campuses. It's a nationwide effort to get Jewish kids to learn something Jewish. So they have the Maimonides Scholars Circle. It's a thing that you could be a part of. You get paid $400 or $500 for the semester. You go to 10 two-hour, usually 2.5-hour encounters. So it's a class, a break, a class. 10 of those and 4 Jewish experiences, whatever they can arrange for, usually 1 Shabbaton. And if they can get a wedding or bris or, you know, other Jewish things.
They pay the kids to do this?
And they pay the kids to do it. So it's a fellowship,
interesting,
so to speak.
Okay.
But it's also a money-driven thing. There's plenty of kids who are doing it just for the cash.
Well, right.
Yeah.
But the idea is you get the exposure. And
right, that's the idea.
Sinks in.
That's the idea.
The osmosis effect is there.
Right, that's the idea. And then if you complete the program, which most people do, then you're also entitled to a free trip to Israel during the winter break or the summer break, whatever.
Well, that's a cool thing.
So they're really hitting them hard, you know, trying to get them some education, get them to Israel, and then try to get them into Maimonides too. Wolfson. God bless them.
Okay.
Yeah. So I was speaking to my Maimonides group, and I was telling them my journey story. So I said that at 19, you know, I was considering marriage like every other 19-year-old girl does. And they all laughed because I knew none of them are considering who they're going to marry now. You know, like, what are you thinking about marriage, right? But that is, you know, it is just a different, I just wanted to also draw that contrast for them, like thinking about marriage. And you have to prepare for marriage. What does that mean? Who are you thinking about? Like, so it's interesting. all right. So here we are at 191 then, the prohibition of conjugal intimacy with one's father's wife, even if she is not his mother. So your stepmother.
Right.
So no stepmothers. And that's why we can go really fast through these, because I just gave you a ton of like thoughts about, you know, what all this stuff is. Okay, so no stepmothers. 192, not to uncover a sister's nakedness if she is one sister in any way. So that's half-sister.
Half-sister, whatever.
So it doesn't say stepsister. That's a different thing. Because it's a half-sister from either side or a full sister. That's what sister in any way.
Okay.
Not steps.
Adopted sister and brother are right?
Right. Adopted sister and brother are not forbidden from each other. They're permitted to each other, which is interesting. Yeah.
It is interesting.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, because that really, I mean, it may be, I wonder.
It almost influences the genetic
argument.
Concern. Right.
Well, so I'm just wondering if there's possibly a rabbinic prohibition
against
that. I heard somewhere at some point, sister and a brother that had been adopted, 2 children had been adopted in the same family. They did get married.
It feels incestuous.
Right.
But it's not.
No, I know. It's not. Yeah. I just said it feels like it.
Household.
They grew up in the same home. They have the same, quote, mother and father, unquote. That's what I said. They're not.
Right.
Because of our attitude and approach towards adopted kids who basically don't have any connection with their birth parents, you know, it feels...
Right. It feels not, except
feels.
For, that is what you said initially, it's based on our current perceptions of adoption, you know, that there is that full transfer over to the other parents and into the other family. But I think what the halacha is reflecting that there's not a full and complete 100%. There isn't, because, yeah, there is that difference, and there is... And then it speaks of the genetics, but it's not just the genetics, obviously, because it's a real problem today. There is the genetic component, but it's not just that, which you can see through the sperm donor problem. You know, there are donor siblings today.
That's a huge issue.
Right, but it's a huge issue today. So first of all, there's some pull to find out who your donor siblings are.
So you know. Right, there is that.
No, there's a pull in your guts. I want to be related to the people I'm related to.
Absolutely.
Right? So people want to know who their donor siblings are, and they create fraternity of donor siblings. You know, like they might do things to get, like cousins kind of. And depending on the parents, I mean, I have friends who have a donor child. I mean, it's the mom's egg, and they have facilitated a relationship between their son and his donor siblings, and have done some things together, some traveling together,
and
some communication together.
Has you know, she has twins that are from a donor, and I remember that she told us at one point that she was checking online because there's all these things, and there's a website from somebody in Florida or whatever even that has this connection of all these people from the same donor.
Right. You know, so there is that desire. On the one hand, there's the gut desire to be related to those that you're related to. And on the other hand, there's the halachic imperative to know, because you can't marry any of them. Right? They're all forbidden in marriage.
Saying the concern in Israel,
and then there's the genetic problem.
Is even more because it's such a smaller society, such a smaller pool. Yes.
Right. So, I mean, I'm sure there is all kinds of halachic stuff there. Anyway, so we see that it's a genetic thing, and it's also a family thing, and then it's also an influence thing, but it can't just be that either. It has to be more, because otherwise there would be at least a rabbinic prohibition against adopted, marrying with adopted, and there's not, as far as I know. So it's interesting also, just parenthetically, and I'm not, I haven't ever seen this happen, but just halachically, to a brother and a sister from the same parents who convert to Judaism are so not related to each other halachically that they could get married.
What?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Why is that?
Right. Right.
And how is it that they're not related halachically?
So I think the idea is really to teach the halachic principle, because I think we're basically relying, I wonder if there's a rabbinic prohibition or not. I'm not sure about that.
But we're just going
with the halachic principle. The concept is, when you convert, you are a different person.
I see.
And you're that different.
But your parents are still your parents.
No.
You still have the genetics.
Not halachically.
So halachically,
they're not. So they're halachically adoptive parents.
That's what I was
going to
say.
They're halachically, so you have the same responsibility towards them as you do towards adoptive parents, which is tremendous hakaras hatov. And you're required to care for them into their old age, just like you are with a parent. However, they're not your halachic parent. So there's certain things in the halachas of Kvod Av V'Aim that you're not required to do. Like, for instance, never contradicting. You're not supposed to contradict a parent. Those kinds of things that fall on a child, a biological child, don't necessarily fall on an adoptive child. So, and then Shiva laws, for instance, also. It's an option to sit Shiva, but it's not a requirement. So there's things like that, between.
Yeah.
So
even in your situation.
So in my situation, as a.
Two kids that were raised by their parents, but then became from. The kids did. They wouldn't have to sit Shiva for the parents.
Let's see. You're saying that in the situation.
Well, these are Gentile.
Not in my situation. No, my parents are Gentile parents.
Gentile parents.
Okay, so then. Once the kids converted to Judaism, they would not sit OIC.
I'm not sure about it. Now, it's different for when a whole family converts.
Well, their parents are not Jewish. That's nothing to
do. Right, right.
Yeah, that's a
Jewish. Right, right, right. So that's what I'm saying. No, you can. A Jewish child of Gentile parents is permitted to sit Shiva for their Gentile parent. They're permitted to. But they are not required to. They're not obligated to. And what I've seen in general, there has been conversation among friends, what do you do about that? So there is some kind of convert conversation about that. Most people I know have not done it.
Really?
Yeah, they haven't. They do not sit Shiva for their parents. A lot of people really feel at a loss. How do they deal with the loss of their parent?
Because
they don't feel like they're connected in with the network to do that for their parent. So I don't know myself. I'm not sure.
And some are ignorant of it.
Yeah, some are ignorant that they may.
Right. Could.
Right.
Right. So they don't even know that they have a choice.
They wanted to honor them in a particular way,
because it is so much about those that are living.
Right.
I
could see doing it, and I can see not doing it. For me, myself personally, I mean, even though I think of myself as a pretty open person, it is such an emotionally vulnerable time, and you're forced to be vulnerable in Shiva. You have to sit there and be in pain in public and talk about it. And I could easily see for myself saying,
I don't have to, so
I'm not going to. I'd rather be private in my pain, and like I'll share a story or two, but I don't need to be this vulnerable in public, So I could see that too. If I'm not required, then not having to do it.
Don't you feel in a way that it would sort of, I mean, the whole process.
Right. No, I see the wisdom of the process. Right. Right, right. I see the wisdom of the process. And I just
spoke. It's funny because I never thought about it as an exposure issue.
Yeah.
Personally, I'm just talking about
personal
thing. Mm-hmm. I never thought about it as an exposure issue.
I don't think it is if you have to.
Well, maybe.
You know what I'm saying? But if you're choosing it. There's a difference there.
Different to you.
Yeah, to me it feels very different.
Some people are going to wonder, why are you doing this? You don't really have to.
Right.
Other people who don't
know. So why are you doing it?
And I guess those people could just be coming for you, but they have absolutely no connection with these Gentile people that, were my parents. And... sometimes in the Jewish world, the Gentile world is not as revered as
you're saying there may be a lack of respect.
A little bit, a little bit. You know, they're just not on the same level or so. I have enough learning that I might wind up with that feeling that, you know, I don't, they, but if they're coming to
they would come for the person.
And
right,
then
right.
Probably
it's,
do it.
Right.
Yeah.
But I can see
that. Okay.
Yeah. And the obligation makes a huge difference, yeah. Just like the obligation of Shabbos. You know, like, if you'll say every Wednesday, I am turning off my cell phone, I don't answer emails, you can't bother me, and this is my day of rest. You can't respect it, and other people can't respect it, because you're picking it, so you could pick out, mm-hmm. You know? Mm-hmm. But with Shabbos, there's an enforced day of rest. It doesn't matter. You're on vacation, you're not on vacation. You're home, you're not. It's convenient, it's not convenient. The power's out, the power's on. You had enough grocery shopping time, you didn't. It doesn't matter. It's Shabbos, and you have Shabbos. Right? So then there's the protective factor. So I was just speaking to Sarah Lisa Scheinberg, who's lost her father 7.5 months ago. She has 4.5 months, whatever the math is. She has 4.5 left in Detroit. So, she said that it's hard, and the kids have been asking, like, when is it over? Because they don't listen to music in the house because she's an availus. So the kids are permitted in their room, but in the car they don't. And they're missing it, you know, because their mother's driving them everywhere. So they miss it. They want to know, when is it going to be over? Mm-hmm. So she recently she told them last week, you know, it's 4.5 months. And when she said 4.5 months, she told me, she said, I felt like that's so short. Like, mm-hmm. It's such a protective cocoon to be in availus, to have that protection of, no, I can't go to a simcha, no, I can't listen to music, no, I can't receive a gift, no, I can't buy something new. She said, I so feel like it's protective and it helps me process, but only because it's an obligation. If it wasn't an obligation, it wouldn't be so protective, because then it's not protective. Then you can choose to, when your close friend says, can't you come to my kid's wedding? You could say, I'm an availus, but you're choosing it, right? Mm-hmm. So you're choosing to respect your parent over respecting your friend, as opposed to the halacha that requires it. Anyway, yeah. Let's see. And back to this mitzvah 192 of no carnal relations with any sister. That is one of the laws that also falls on other nations, not just a Jewish law, right? That, you know, the Sheva Mitzvot B'nai Noach include no forbidden sexual relations. When we list them, generally we use the language no adultery, but that's inappropriate. It's not just adultery. It's not limited to that. So it includes, it's
the
no.
The mother one also.
Yeah, the mother one also.
Is also incumbent on them.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep, it is. Okay, 193, the prohibition of conjugal intimacy with the daughter of a son. So now we're getting into, so we have daughter of a son, daughter's daughter, So grandchildren, can't do grandchildren, and I think we have it the other way too. Anyway.
Yeah, there's so.
But it doesn't say, so let's look to 195, the prohibition of conjugal intimacy with a daughter. So just look at the top of this mitzvah, the top of every other mitzvah, you'll see there's italics right at the top, right? So you look at 194, there's italics underneath. You look at 193, there's italics underneath.
Right.
You look at 195, no italics. Why?
Right.
The italics are a verse, right? So it's saying, let's just look at the form of 194. The mitzvah is not to uncover the nakedness of a daughter's daughter, for it is written in the italics instead of quote, or of your daughter's daughter, even their nakedness you shall not uncover, for theirs is your own nakedness. Okay? So now if we look at 195, not to uncover a daughter's nakedness. This was not made clear in the text of the Torah by the writs saying, no italics, the nakedness of your daughter you shall not uncover. That's not a verse. We don't have any verse that says that, right? So that's why I decided to look at this a little bit more, right? No verse says that. It's not explicit anywhere. We learn it from a kal v'chomer. So we learn it actually from two different things. So that's why I want to spend just a drop of time on these two different things, kal v'chomer and a gzera shava. So a kal v'chomer is an inference by reasoning. In Latin, it's a, you're the lawyer, so a fortiori. Yeah, a fortiori. Okay, argument.
An inference by reason.
Right, so it means you learn one thing out from another, right? So if it says no granddaughter, obviously it's no daughter.
Right.
Right? So if it says no, milk after eating meat, obviously it's also no butter. You don't have to say no butter. You know, it's no
anything
that comes from it. It's just obvious. Like, you don't have to list every single thing. You know, once you say one thing, it's very clear that the other thing, right, that the other thing is there too. So that's called a kal v'chomer, right? You learn the kal from the chomer. So chomer is, in this case, chomer has two different meanings, right? Chomer can mean material stuff. In this case, it means chamur, astringent thing, like chumrah. It's the same root as the word chumrah, astringency. So you're learning the easy, the kal thing, kal meaning lightweight or easy. You're learning the easier thing from the more difficult thing. So if you have a descendant, the difficult thing that you can't have relations with, obviously the close-up thing, you also can't. Right,
saying.
Just goes without saying. Kal v'chomer. Okay, so that's what a kal v'chomer is. So you certainly learn the prohibition of conjugal intimacy. It's interesting, though, that it's listed as a mitzvah, because we don't list a mitzvah from a kal v'chomer. But we do from a gzera shava. So you also learn it from a gzera shava. So gzera shava, shava comes from the word equal. Shaveh is equal. So gzera shava is a decree of equalness, or we see there's an equal comparison. So when you see language that's similar, then you know that it's the same. So let me just make something up if I can. So if it says, let's see. If there's a verse that says, you're not allowed to sit on a chair, you know, you will surely hurt your hip if you do, okay, right? So you're not allowed to. But then you see something else, so that's a direct verse, and there's a clear prohibition, you're not allowed to sit on a chair, right? But then you see something else that doesn't say, you're not allowed to, it says, going on a swing will surely hurt your hip. But it doesn't say you're not allowed to. Right? It just says the same, you have the same second half of the verse. Going on a swing will surely hurt your hip. You're not permitted to sit on a chair, it will surely hurt your hip. Right?
So you take the
prohibition with the surely hurt your hip, and you move it over to the verse with the same consequence, surely hurt your hip, and you learn from that that there's a prohibition to sit on the swing. Right? Even though it doesn't say.
It's interesting, and to me, that would be deemed an inference also.
But because of the language, it's a gezerah shava.
Gotcha.
If you're saying it, it's the same kind of language. Right? So once you hear the same language, even when one of them doesn't say, you shall not, you can learn that you shall not. So, you
and
learn.
That is from the rabbis who told us that? Or we just
right.
know that?
No. So it would be great if I knew enough. There's 13 principles of deriving halacha and deriving information from the Torah, and this is one of them, how you do it.
Okay.
How
so
you
it's
do
sort
it.
Of a, it's like
it's
the
a principle of, yeah.
that has been established.
It's a principle of halachic derivation. Okay. How do you do it? And this is one of the ways. So
Shava is what?
Equal.
Equal.
Shava. For any Hebrew listeners, Shava shivui mishkal is equilibrium. It's the exact translation, because shivui, shave, equal, and mishkal is weight or scale, libra, librium, the equal weight, so equilibrium, shivui, mishkal. So in shave, you say shave, sometimes you say it's not shave in English, I mean in Jewish English, you know, it's just not worth it, shave. And then,
does that sound not a shave. Bah sound?
Well, it depends on how you're using it in which context.
Yeah, if I'm saying
gezerah. In the gezerah shava.
Shava.
Okay. Right. Which is different than shaveh, equal. It's the same, but it's the same root. But shaveh is equal in a math equation, too. You could say, achad plus shtaim shaveh le shalosh. Right? Okay. Is equal to. Okay. Right, so there's a gezerah shava, and it goes on at length discussing the gezerah shava and how it works. And so if you understand this book as being written for the bar mitzvah boy, he's taking this mitzvah as an opportunity to discuss that concept and how it works. Mm. So he's not just explaining the mitzvah, but because you can see among all these long lists, he's teaching a methodology within this mitzvah because it's 4 pages long here. Right. So he's teaching him how to do that. let's see. Yeah, and there's interesting things that he says. Where is that one, too? Okay, he goes on, and then, let's see, on page 317, I flagged this to mention. I have to remember why I flagged it. Rambam of Blessed Memory wrote, "Notice that the sages of Blessed Memory said in the middle of the page, and Scripture did not teach it, but they did not say, and we did not learn it." Right, Scripture didn't teach it, but we did learn it. "Because all these matters are elements of oral tradition from the messenger of the eternal Lord, peace be upon him," that's Moshe, "who transmitted the explanation to the elders. In this sense, they spoke of it as the main law of the Torah." So he's saying that these principles of explanation, maybe if it doesn't come straight from a pasuk, straight from Scripture, still it is something that we learn out, which becomes then a mitzvah d'oraisa, even though the pasuk didn't say it. So it's a biblical commandment, not a rabbinic commandment, that was information derived but not explicitly stated in the verse. Looking on page 319, let's see, in 319.
Biblical, not rabbinic.
And then there's a fence. Okay, so there's a fence. So let's look at the middle paragraph on 319. "For this reason, the sages of blessed memory taught that by the law of the Torah, if a man raped a woman, he should be permitted to marry her daughter by another man," because they're not married, right? So you can't marry, let's see. Oh, because now they're discussing, this is longer in the mitzvah, so we've already discussed that you can't marry your wife's daughter. But if he raped a woman, that's not his wife. So her daughter technically should be permitted. Right? Technically should be permitted. "But the sages of blessed memory erected a fence and banned the matter, ruling that if someone had immoral conjugal relations with a woman, he is forbidden to marry any one of her 7 known female relatives as long as the immoral woman is alive." Meaning she wasn't immoral, but he was immoral with her. So as long as that woman is alive that he raped, he's not allowed to marry any of her relatives, because the immoral woman will come to visit them, and he will be alone with her. And since his heart is overly familiar with her, he will be led into the grip of sin and be conjugally intimate with an absolutely forbidden woman. Because once he marries one of those relatives, then she is forbidden to him.
Right?
Besides the rape, that's a different kind of forbidden. But then there's an additional prohibition kicks in. So for that reason, even if he raped her, so there's a fence that he can't marry then any of her female relatives. Even more, if a man is but suspected of immorality with a woman, he is not to marry any of her near relatives until the one about whom he is suspected dies. Nevertheless, if he did wed a woman who is closely related to the one with whom he was immorally intimate, he is not required or compelled to divorce her. Now, all this can sound so dry, but there are halachic principles derived from all this. So this is definitely dat. Right, so we talked about the difference between bina and dat in other classes, but here is a clear case of dat. There's no discussion of how bad rape is, how she feels, would she, that's all bina, right? Mm-hmm. That's not this discussion. This discussion is just what are the halachic implications of it if it happens. It's straight up dat. So we're just discussing, so it's hard in a way as women to discuss this so coldly.
Right.
Right? Which is why Gemara study, for instance, develops dot at the expense of bina, to be able to engage in this discussion with such clarity and coldness to get the clarity on it. You know, so if he does, is he forbidden from marriage? Can he divorce her or not divorce? Does he have to divorce her? What's the law? Right? It's all so cold.
Well, you have to just put the bina aside.
Exactly. And that's what this is saying. However, putting the bina aside as an exercise is not so healthy for us. So I'm just mixing it back in a little bit by saying that, you know, that you can just see that does require a coldness that is appropriate in studying halacha.
But not in life necessarily,
right? So we don't want to just fully divorce ourselves from our bina as an exercise. It's not even healthy as an exercise to have to take it out of the picture. Mm-hmm. So we just want to recognize, you know, the pain of this woman who was raped and what it would be like. But, right, so he doesn't have to divorce her.
And the reality is this particular mitzvah where the fence and everything, in a way, does respect that, because imagine the pain of that person,
right,
if the perpetrator was in her life
and now married to right. How awful would that be? The perpetrator now marries her daughter, and now what?
Yeah, now
she's the mother-in-law of her rapist. Oh, how awful would that be?
Right. think right. about that. I mean, then it's not something you can even, like, get over.
Right, right, right. You can never,
because
right.
it's always, like, I mean.
Right, right, always right there. Then. Right. Okay, 196, the prohibition of conjugal relations with with a sister on the father's side who is the father's wife.
Oh, gosh, you need a map.
Right, you totally do. You totally do. So, right, yeah.
Sister.
Right, so yeah, we'll figure that one out.
Father's side.
Sister on the father's side who is the father's wife's daughter. Huh? I think yeah. that is yours. Is could that yeah. be your stepsister?
Yeah, it would be like a stepsister.
Sister on the father's side. Who is the father's? So oh no! It's still related. It's still related. It's your half sister.
Right.
It's your half sister. But you would think that should be covered in your prohibition of not having relations with your sister.
Right.
Right.
I thought that it was.
Right. She is. In
is
other words. If she is his father's daughter, so it's the father's daughter, for she is the daughter of his father's wife who's not a sister, we've already stated above that he's permitted from the start to take her for a wife. Thus it only means the daughter of his father's wife who is his sister, as it is stated, the nakedness of your father's wife's daughter, begotten of your father, you shall not uncover. So why does that have to be? Right? As I have already written above about the forbiddance of a sister, that this injunction was given to make the daughter from one's father's marriage forbidden by a separate extra ban. So this is an additional prohibition on the same person, really. So, because it could be a half-sister, let's see, it could be a half-sister through adultery, and then that's only one prohibition. But if it's a half-sister through your father's marriage, it's a double prohibition.
Oh, okay.
That's what it's saying, right? It's a double prohibition. Not just your sister in any way, which is its own prohibition,
anyway, right?
But if it's also your sister and also the daughter of your father's wife, it's a double prohibition. Right. So I'm sure there's many secrets in this. I mean, we should know that.
Right.
So we should just daven that the effective learning
don't
secrets should. No, but I'm saying there is something that affects the soul about learning Torah. So, and I don't know enough to teach you the levels of the secrets here. So let's just keep in mind that we have the kavana, that the effect of learning the secrets of the Torah on our neshama should still take place, even though our mind isn't coming into touch with the secrets. But we're still.
All right, we'll go
okay.
for that. I'll go for that.
Okay. 197, the prohibition of conjugal intimacy with the father's sister. Okay, pretty similar. Prohibition of conjugal intimacy with the mother's sister. So no aunts on either side. Prohibition, okay, here's a sticky one. Prohibition of carnal relations with the father's brother. This is not directed to a woman.
Oh, it's not directed to a woman.
No.
Yes.
Okay. This is directed to a man. So even though we haven't yet arrived, and we will meet next week or the week after, we'll see, at the prohibition of having sex with another man.
So this would be like
this
a double
is a double prohibition,
oh, okay.
right? This is adding on. If it's your father's brother, it's an extra one. So now it's interesting that it says in here, just to get lucky about it. Let's see. They talk about, and again, straight up dot, no bina here. If the sin took place unwittingly, how could that happen, right? That's the bina asking. But the dot is the halacha.
Yeah, you still got sin.
Right, the dot is the halacha. So if it happened unwittingly, the punishment is bringing a chatat. If it happened on purpose, then and there were witnesses, then the punishment is stoning. If it happened on purpose and there were no witnesses, then the punishment is karet. However, it's different in having sex with another man where they're both...
Right, because you're not to lie with any man.
Right.
Right.
Okay. In that mitzvah, the punishment falls on both of them, the active participant and the passive participant. Whereas this additional overlay of an additional prohibition only applies to the active participant, not to the passive participant. Because the way that it says is, shelo lavo al achi ha'av, do not come to the brother of your father. So that's the active, that's an active, let's see, where is the one on, what's the language for a man? Let's see, menstruant. Well, it still says, shelo lavo al hazcharim. But it's not. So because here the way he names the mitzvah is shlo lavo al zacharim, here the, let's see, the pasuk is. Father's voice, brother, I moved back over to, where did it go? It disappeared from me. Where's brother's, father's brother, 200, okay. Now, where did that go? Father's brother, 199, okay. I just want to look at the pasuk. You shall not uncover the nakedness of your father's brother. So that's uncovering the nakedness, right? So that was what happened. As opposed to with homosexual relations, it says, and with a male you shall not lie carnally as with a woman. So it's two different languages, so that the second, the prohibition against homosexuality falls on both participants. You shall not lie carnally with, right? Whereas this one is just, you shall not uncover the nakedness, which applies only to the active participant. And that's what the halacha is. It applies only to the active participant, not to the passive one. That's what it says.
Take your
word for it. Right. Wait a second. Here it says both will be put to death. So where does it say the active and the passive?
Well, it takes two hatat.
Oh, that's only if it was by mistake. Only if it was by mistake, and the passive one. Only if it was by mistake, okay. It's the passive one that isn't right. The problem, right?
Right. That's what
whatever that means, right. Right? Right. Okay. So that's what I'm saying. That's what that's the Bina talking. How could that be a mistake? I don't see how, right? But the dot is just discerning the halacha, because the halacha does teach principles, and right. So that's where, yeah.
Maybe one party was not aware that this was in.
That's the Bina talking. It doesn't matter.
I know,
right.
But I'm just saying maybe that's
how could they might not have been aware of the family relationship. Yeah. They might, but
that,
just
that
it's homosexual.
That could have been by
right.
Is what I meant.
Right.
You'd still be by.
You'd still be prohibiting this homosexual thing, right? Right.
For sure.
Right. Right.
For sure.
Right. Okay. 200, the prohibition of conjugal relations with a wife of a father's brother. So here, it's not consanguinous, right? You're not related. There's no blood relationship there. But you still have the person is close to you, close by you, should be an influence in your life, not crossing that boundary of family stuff.
All of these things, I mean, if you think about them with the emotional aspect as opposed to just the pure dot, make perfect sense.
Right.
I mean, it's impossible to maintain family closeness and all that stuff with this stuff going on.
Right.
I mean, you just can't do it.
No, you can't.
Yeah,
right.
You just can't. I mean, you can't have,
right.
You know, you have people to your house. I mean, it's like.
Right. So that's why I started out with the radiating sexual attractiveness.
Right.
If you were in a relationship, if you had people over to your house, like whatever it is, people in your orbit, especially shtetl life or whatever,
right,
when people live so close
right.
to each other all the time, and the family structure is very close, and cousins play together, and there's really a family circle, you know, all the time. So it would never work if you had
any
inkling. None of that. No. There has to be just a straight up, you can't do it. Right.
Right.
But I'm sure that there's more to it than that.
I'm sure. That's the
and yet,
club.
Yeah, right. Okay. 202, the prohibition of conjugal relations with a brother's wife. Okay. Now this one is, brother's wife, except for if the brother dies.
Right. And then you're supposed to. You have to
and then, it, yeah, right. So we're not going into that right now. That's the precept of Levirate marriage, which is mitzvah 598. So, but what if the brother's still alive, you're not permitted to have relations with his wife. But if the brother dies, then you're not required to, but you're required to marry her if she wants that marriage. the prohibition 203, the prohibition of conjugal relations with both a woman and her daughter.
Okay.
So, right.
Messy.
Right, right. And I think this is, if you, see, not to cover the, shall not uncover the nakedness of a woman and her daughter. And the interpretation was given that the guilt is not incurred unless it was a case where a person married one first. Afterward, when he's conjugally intimate with the other, he becomes punishable. But if he did not marry one of them, he incurs no guilt on their account because an expression of taking is written about them, lakach, which means by the procedure of marriage. For that is what the expression of taking denotes everywhere, the sense of marriage. So if he's just sleeping around, you know, that's a separate prohibition, but not this one. Right. But if he marries one of them, the mother or the daughter, then he can't
the
have sex.
The other one is forbidden.
The other one's forbidden, right. 204. The prohibition of conjugal intimacy with both a woman and her son's daughter.
So that would be your grand... Well, it doesn't even
it
say...
It would be your step-granddaughter.
Right.
Right?
Right. Among, if you were married to her, if you weren't married to her...
Right, not to uncover the nakedness of a woman and her son's daughter. As we stated previously in 203, that this ban always applies upon marriage with the first one. For it is stated, her son's daughter you shall not take.
So it would be a step-granddaughter.
Right. Among the laws of the precept, there is the restriction that the sages of blessed memory decreed as offense about this on the daughter of a son of her son, who is thus included among the secondary ones. As we stated, any woman banned by a ruling of the sages is called a secondary one. So, too, they prohibited the mother of one's father-in-law alone, and likewise the mother of the father of one's father-in-law alone. Right, so it gets complicated. Right, yeah. 205. The prohibition of conjugal intimacy with both a woman and her daughter's daughter, which we would think would be in the other, right? Okay. So, but what I wanted to point out in this one, and looks like we might actually make it to the end today, if I go quick, is, let's see, on the page, on 335, so it says two sentences down, the rule concerning the ban on marrying a woman and her daughter or son's daughter and daughter's daughter is that a Torah forbids a man to marry 6 near relatives of his wife apart from a sister, 3 above, her mother and her 2 grandmothers, and 3 below, her daughter, daughter's daughter, and son's daughter. So that's the 7 relatives that he can't marry, the 3 above and the 3 below. The sages added to these as well 6 others as a fence, 4 above and 2 below, so that it is right for the matter to be necessarily 2 grandmothers, require 4 others to serve as a fence for them, but as for her son's daughter's daughter, okay, blah, blah, blah. So what he said here is ponder the matter for it is necessarily so. So it's interesting, ponder the matter for it is necessarily so. It's an interesting phrase. We don't find that often, although he's talking to his son. So what is necessarily so? And why should he be pondering that matter? It just shows that there's more stuff in here that it should be pondered. Ponder the matter that's necessarily so. So
think about it.
Yeah, yeah, think about it. Okay, let's try to get to 206. 2, the prohibition of conjugal relations with 2 sisters while both are alive. Mm. So, like Yaakov, right, who married 2 sisters who are both alive. Okay, that's before the Torah was given. However, it is considered to be one of the reasons that Rachel died just before he went into the land. Because once he was in the land, he couldn't really be married to 2 sisters while each one was alive. Mm. So he had Rachel, the wife of his youth, of his passion, of his emotions, of his Yaakov side. And Leah was the wife of his mission, his journey, his intellect, his Yisrael side.
And she was alive still.
And she was alive still when he switched to be functioning as Yisrael in the land of Israel. Right, so that
where
one.
Where did they live most of the time?
I guess just outside. I mean, the biblical borders,
right.
Which is interesting. I mean, I thought that Bethlehem.
They left up north. You know, they left Laban.
Right. So, it's a good question, and I'm not quite sure. And it seems to me, I mean, she's buried. Rachel is buried on the way to Beit Lechem.
Right.
Bethlehem, so right there, and I think of that as the biblical land of Israel, I'm pretty sure that it is.
Right.
I think the Gaza Strip might not be biblically Israel, but I'm not positive.
That was where the Philistines were. Most of
them. Right, so I don't know the exact boundaries of biblical Israel.
Well, and maybe it didn't mean boundaries, maybe it meant...
It could just be function, right,
function.
It is very long.
Right.
Right, it did mean function.
Yeah.
But the boundaries make a difference too in terms of Shemitah and all that kind of stuff, right?
In the land.
Right. Okay, so we're not going to look at all of this because it's very late, but I did want to show one thing here. Okay, on page 341.
This is really a long one.
Yeah, it really is. And maybe we'll look at it again, but I guess 339 at the bottom of the page and we'll read over. In any event, though, the man's wife, meaning the sister whom he married first, does not become forbidden to him on account of his marriage or immoral relations with the second one. So even if he does, if he marries both, the second one doesn't become forbidden to him. I think that's what it says, right?
Yeah.
In any event, though, the man's wife. Oh, no. He marries. Let's just.
So he marries one, first. And then he has relations with the sister.
He doesn't have to divorce the one he married. He doesn't have to divorce the one he married.
Okay. And the second one has to go away.
But the second one does have to go. However, let's say he marries the second one or any one of the other ones that are forbidden to him. What's the story with that?
Really,
does he need to divorce them?
They're not married.
They're not married. That's what I wanted to point out. They're not actually. In other words, she does not become his in any respect, and she needs no divorce from him. So even if they stand under a chuppah, even if she gets a ring and a ketubah, it was all not. It was all a sham, right? It's not actual marriage. So I'm not sure, but I know that's not an actual. A kohen can't marry a divorcee or a gerut.
Right.
So I don't know what happens if he does. Does she need a get or not? I'm not sure if it's on the same level, but. There are certain things that just aren't marriages. They just can't be married. So,
but I think what's even more interesting is if you go down to the next paragraph, where it says if somebody marries somebody who's forbidden to them on any basis, they're not really married.
Right.
Any of them.
Right. So a Jew and a non-Jew, it's not a marriage. They could live together.
Married.
They could be happy, but they're not. It's not a marriage.
Kohen and a divorced one.
So that's what I'm just saying. I'm pretty sure. I mean, I happen to know of a couple that's a Kohen and a divorced woman, friends in another state. And when she was first contemplating marriage to him, the Kohen, the ex-husband came to me, because we were friends with a couple before they got divorced, and was furious that I was still friends with her. Because she's about to marry a Kohen, and that's Usser. Not only that, it was pretty clear. She started that relationship in the marriage, so it's adultery, and that's Usser, and how can I still be friends? And so he said, I want you to ask a Shiloh about that. Are you permitted to even talk to her? So I didn't think it was a problem talking to her, maintaining a friendship, but I said, okay, I will ask the Shiloh. So the Shiloh that I asked was, am I still allowed to be friends? And especially because she had two kids, and I wanted to still be an influence. We were very close when they were married. So I wanted to be an influence in the family. So, and then the tshuva was, and I couldn't believe I sat with the Rav, he said, you are allowed to still be friends with her, but you have to tell her that it's completely forbidden to get married to him, and each and every sexual encounter is a separate Isur.
Wow.
Whew. I was like, what do you mean I have to tell her that? That was not the Shayla. Not at all. I did not come to ask that at all. Not at all.
Answer questions in our
I know.
Part of the answer. May not be.
Oh my gosh, that was so hard to try to just drop that in conversation.
Because
you can't just sit her down and say, you know, your ex said I should ask a shaya, so I did. And the tshuva is, I couldn't say that to her. Yeah. You know, you'd have to casually say it. So I recently learned in a halacha book that each and every.
Who would marry them?
A conservative rabbi.
Conservative?
Yeah, they. I mean, yeah. She had to leave Orthodoxy to be able to marry him. Yeah. Yep. So they.
Did she?
Leave Orthodoxy? Yes, she married him, and yes, she left Orthodoxy, and yeah, they're married. And
was he conservative to begin with?
He wasn't observant. The Cohen wasn't observant to begin with, but she was.
Yes.
So it's just interesting to watch the struggle inside her, how she.
Right.
Worked with her cognitive dissonance to be able to say that these mitzvahs weren't really, it wasn't clear that you had to keep them. But what was clear is the relationship with this guy. So it was watching that.
Living on denial.
Yeah, it was. It was fascinating to watch. Really fascinating to watch. Yeah, they really did.
Yeah.
So it seems that they wouldn't have to get divorced if they would get divorced because they're not actually married.
Right.
Right.
So are you really transgressing that same mitzvah, if you really can't marry them, you're not transgressing that mitzvah.
It's not a mitzvah. So, yeah, you transgressed. The mitzvah isn't.
You didn't marry a Kohen.
Right, so it doesn't say.
You know what I mean?
But you can't have sexual relations with them. Regardless of whether you're married or not.
Unmarried, okay.
That would have to be the question. Right, because I knew
having sexual relations with a Kohen.
Yes.
Even if neither of you are married.
Never been married.
Apart from the regular prohibition of not having sexual relations outside of marriage.
Okay.
Right? So apart from that, because that's a regular prohibition.
Right.
But let's just say there was a a Jewish girl who, for whatever reason, went to the mikvah, right? So that you're not transgressing that, right? Mm-hmm. So then there's only the transgression of you're supposed to, it really is a transgression of what they call znus, which we translate as prostitution. It doesn't necessarily mean prostitution because there's not money being exchanged, right. But it means taking sexuality lightly and using it only for physical. You're not building a relationship outside of marriage, just shacking up with somebody. You know, even if it's a long-term relationship, it's not a long-term commitment. You're not building a relationship. You're just enjoying the person over a longer period of time, right? Mm-hmm. So that's considered znus by the Torah. So so it would still be znus. But it wouldn't be usher for them to get married later because that's an okay relationship. The actual, right. So that's a rabbinic prohibition. It's not a biblical prohibition to have sex if she did go to the mikvah. And she's the type that he could marry, then it's just quote unquote. Marry. Right. So, but for instance, I knew a convert who.
Actually, not an illicit.
No. So, but I knew a convert who fell in love with a Kohen, so she knew they couldn't get married. So she asked the Shaila, can she be his concubine?
Yeah.
No. Meaning they would live together, but she wouldn't be his wife technically. She'd be his concubine technically, but they would. For practical, all practical purposes, they be married. No, because they can't have sex. Right? There is no way. They're not permitted at all. There's no, so that, yeah. No ability at all.
Right.
No way around it. So it's not a marriage at all. So it's not just the marriage. So it's saying go through the ceremony of marriage. You have a chuppah and kedushin. It's not kedushin. It's all errant. You tricked a rabbi into doing it for you. He didn't know. Right, so then it's not effective. You can't marry those two. It doesn't work.
It's a problem for the rabbi if he were to do something like that because he did not use his due diligence.
Right, so today there's a lot more due diligence, which can drive people pretty nuts.
Yeah.
It didn't exist when you got married, or your rabbi probably knew your family. Mm-hmm. And when you guys got married, did you have to produce any kind of document that proved you were Jewish?
No, but I've told you the story about Ethan in
right.
Australia.
It's been torturous.
Oh my gosh.
Right?
He had
torture.
To prove.
Yeah, today it's torture.
He had to totally prove he was Jewish, mm-hmm. and he had to produce all the stuff, and
right.
he was pissed.
Right.
Because
right.
he was in the Israeli army, and he, you know, did
right.
I, and he said, you know, if it's good enough for them, it ought to be good enough for you, and did I. But
right.
in Australia, and
right.
I don't know if that's true here, but in Australia,
well,
I mean,
never
they made
know
him.
What kind of problems
and
they
I
have
had
been
to
uncovered
produce,
in that society.
Right. I had to produce a letter. That I had, that I happened to have, that was from my rabbi when I was growing up, that said I was Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
Because
for your daughter.
That's what I needed for him to be able to get citizenship in Israel. I had to produce that letter, and so I had it, so that
mm-hmm.
was satisfactory.
Mm-hmm.
That
right.
was satisfactory
uh-huh.
for
right.
them. But if I hadn't had the letter, which
right.
the rabbi was long gone.
Right. Right.
How would I have proven it?
Right. Or your parents' ketubah. That's the one way, too.
Yeah.
But you're right.
Which,
right.
if you don't have.
Right.
Right. Right.
Wonder,
no, it's tricky.
I wonder if Rocky Krauss went through this when she married Ellie.
Right. So it's. Right, so there are different countries where you do have to prove it. England, you have to. So places where there's a central rabbinic authority, we don't have that in this country.
Yeah.
So in this country, it just depends. Sometimes a rabbi will ask to see whatever, or if he doesn't know, or he'll just make a phone call or check it out, or. You know, whatever it is, but
I mean, with the kind of culture that we have, where people travel, you know, move
right.
from place.
That's
to
why it's much more difficult. That's why
it's
I would
really
think
hard. Like
extremely
I said,
hard.
I would have proven it otherwise.
Right, it's extremely hard. So that's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
I'm just pointing out that we, you know, that people were drop older, got married at a time when the rabbi knew them and their family a little bit. Not the case today, and kids are being asked to produce documents that's not always easy
to
produce.
Mm-hmm.
Right, right.
I mean, I have no idea how I would have done that.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So you might have, you can get, it's harder in a non-religious world, because if you get testimony of Shomer Shabbos Jews who know your family is Shomer Shabbos,
right, so.
Then that counts as a proof that you're Jewish.
Right.
You know, but
it's
right,
it's
but it's tricky outside of that to say, like, you know, and Kohen Levi status also, you have to have a Shomer Shabbos living relative. If you don't know for sure that you are, but you, let's say you uncover, you did your, you know, Europe trip because you went on some kind of, you know, Holocaust thing, and you go to your, you find your grandfather's
right.
grave and you see the Kohanic hands on it, and you're like,
oh
I didn't know we were Kohanes.
Right.
Now you know you're a Kohen, but there's no living relative that's Shomer Shabbos that knows that. So then the chain is broken. And I think that I'm pretty sure that the family is considered not Kohanic anymore.
Oh.
But if there is, even without proof, if there's a Shomer Shabbos relative, mm-hmm. even if, you know, some grandson, you know, visits and the Shomer Shabbos relative says, you know, did you know that I knew you're Zadie and he was a Kohen, you should be a Kohen too. You know, so then that's different. Then that's enough for that kid to know that he has Kohanic descent. Yeah. Yeah.
Does the same apply to the Levites?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. Kohen's, yeah. I mean, yeah. I would imagine that Kohen is more stringent just because they still have duties today and responsibilities today, whereas the duties of the Levi today is just to wash the hands of the Kohen. Mm-hmm. So it's not a big halachic implication. But a Kohen can't go into the hospital for, you know, being around dead people, but also gives the bracha. So you would be an improper channel. You know, you have that privilege of giving the bracha at Birkat Kohanim. Mm-hmm. So there's more halachic implications of being a Kohen today than being a Levi, except for the Aliyahs.
Right.
You know, so, but I think it's the case for Levium also that you have to have some kind of
documentation.
You have to have a living Masorah.
Yeah.
If your Masorah is not living, in order to reestablish it, you have to have somebody living who knows.
That knows.
Yeah, it's a living Masorah. That's how we know. It passes down through living people who keep the Masorah. Even if you don't keep the mitzvahs, you just know. Right. You know, you could be completely, you know, pork eating, you know, non-Shomer Shabbos, whatever, Yom Kippur eating person, but you know you're a Kohen, you're a Kohen. You know, and your kid's a Kohen. You have the living transmission. So. Okay. I will not be here next week, but the week after that I will be here. Yes.